Welcome, Carrie.
Hey, thank you.
Good to have you here. I want to tell you, you're a special person. You're special in many ways. I'll tell you that before we even begin. But Queer Writers of Crime launched in October of 2019. This is episode number 147.
Congrats.
And over all those episodes, you, Carrie Ellen Johnson, is the first guest to be featured for a full episode who is not here for writing a mystery, suspense, or thriller novel. Congratulations.
Thanks. That's quite an honor. Thank you.
Well, if you're out there scratching your head, I'll help you with a longer introduction than normal. So this is going to be pretty lengthy, so hang on with me here, and it'll make sense in the end. Carrie is a native of Brooklyn, New York. He's a longtime innovator in national and international queer politics and cultural activism. Carrie was involved in several groundbreaking organizations, including the Gay Men of African Descent. He was a founding member of Other Countries, which is a Black gay arts collective. His short stories, poetry, and essays have appeared in numerous anthologies and literary journals. He's held leadership positions with Amnesty International, Outright Action International, and the UN High Commissions for Refugees. He's a public health and HIV specialist with experience living in and working in Guinea, Haiti, Mali, Rwanda, Senegal, South Africa, Ukraine, and Zimbabwe. And he is currently the Director of Population Services International in Burundi, which is where he is sitting right now. What's the actual city you're in?
Bujumbura, which is the economic capital of Burundi, yeah. It's a beautiful, beautiful little town right on Lake Tanganyika.
Lake Tanganyika. Now that I do know.
Yeah.
Your resume is absolutely amazing, but of all of that, none of that is why you're here, is it?
Actually, it is why I'm here.
I guess in a way it is, isn't it? That's going to make sense in just a moment.
Uh-huh.
The reason Carrie is here is because of his debut novel, Desire Line, which, to put it simply, blew me away. And you will find out everything I just discussed is why he's here, in addition to the book, because it's almost all one and the same. And that's what we'll be talking about, and we're going to talk about it right after this.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shreve.
Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime. I'm Brad, and my guest, as I said earlier, is Carrie Ellen Johnson. Carrie, this is the place where I normally give an intro around two sentences long or so. But I think we've got you covered, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that's a great intro. Thank you.
We met on Instagram, and we've been messaging back and forth for some time. It's funny, I don't do it often, but occasionally when somebody follows me on Instagram, I'll send them a little direct message and say, thank you for following me, and you responded back, and that's how we met. It's a pleasure to finally speak with you live. Because we're breaking tradition here, which is not a permanent change in the format, it's best, I think, to dive right into your novel, Desire Line. It is available for pre-order, and Carrie will have no issue if you do that right now.
None whatsoever.
None whatsoever.
None whatsoever. I have no issue with that whatsoever. Right.
I didn't think you would. This is a tough one. There's a whole lot of story in one novel. I mean, a lot.
Right.
But I want you to whet the listener's appetite. You've got a great blurb, but I call this beyond the blurb.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to tell them as much as you can, whet their appetite. What is this story?
What is the story? Okay, well, the book follows...
It's a really hard question. Go ahead, though.
I knew you were going to ask, so I made some notes. I mean, the book follows basically... The crux of it, sort of like 5 years in the life of the protagonist, and starting in sort of 1983 at the beginning of the HIV and AIDS epidemic in New York. Now, there's some flashback that takes us back to the 70s in New York as the character sort of growing up in Brooklyn and having the experiences that a very young gay man had in that era. Seeing Manhattan across the bridge and the sort of glittering lights of the metropolis. But the main crux of the story is from about 1982, you know, sort of as we're beginning to know, the Times is starting to report on HIV. It's starting to become a common kind of conversation among gay men. And it takes us through to about 1986, 87. And a lot of things happen along the way.
To say the least.
I mean, part of, I think, what's kind of, you know, important and unique in the story is that the character takes this trip to Africa for 2 years. And so there's 2 years that are set, 2 years of the story that are set in Zaire under the Mobutu era. And as he grapples with issues related to sexuality in a, you know, sort of a post-colonial, immediate post-colonial Africa context. And then he comes back to the States and goes through what many gay men went through in that era. And I don't want to give too much away, but, you know, there was something very particular about coming of age. The story has, of course, autobiography in it, but it's not a memoir. It's fiction. But there was something very particular about coming of age at a time when a very strong feeling that one might die and that everyone around one might die, was dying. So that's a big piece of the story. I think that a key element of the story also is the protagonist, the narrator's friendship with his best female friend, which I think is a critical story for gay men quite often, is the relationships that we have with the women in our lives. There are elements of addiction, sex. Well, I'm not going to call it sex addiction because I'm going to call it, there was a certain libertine quality of our lives in that period that some folks have translated that into sex addiction. I translated into, you know, that was an important way for that gay men connected, built community. But drug addiction was very real in that era, still is, and that was part of the story that is told in Desire Lines. And ultimately, things reach a crescendo, and the protagonist has to make some decisions, as we all, most of us have to do at certain points in our lives. And that's the part that I want people to read and sort of see for themselves.
Regarding the sex addiction comment, the exploration of sex during that time, and of course it's pretty open today, but certainly during that era, do you think it's safe to say that in some ways that was the only way that we could express ourselves during that time?
I think that was the entry point for many friendships, relationships, but friendships that, I mean, many of my best friends and I in that era started out as fuck buddies. That was the,
yeah.
You know, met at the baths, met at the park, met at the whatever, and, you know, hit it once, twice, three times, and then decided that we were better off as friends. So I think that there was, sex was the way, the platform that we connected on, those were the spaces that we met in, particularly the bathhouse. I mean, I remember a couple of my favorites, like the New St. Mark's, you know, down on, you know, in the East Village, and Man's Country, and the Barracks. I mean, each of them had its own sort of character. You know, Mount Morris up in Harlem, each of them had its own kind of flavor. And I mean, you went there to make a sexual connection, but you saw your friends, you hung out. Some of them had bars in them. So I think that is how many gay men made connections. And they were connections that sustained us.
In many ways, the bathhouses in certain areas was the central hub of the community. It was almost like the town square.
Absolutely. And the bars, of course. I mean, one of my favorite scenes in the book is when the narrator goes to a bar and he's cruising these two guys. There's two guys standing on either side of the jukebox, and he can't figure out which one he wants or which one wants him. And it turns out the two guys are best friends. And then they all leave, and he's hoping he's going to go home with them. But in fact, they say, okay, we'll see you next week. And they all just become like three musketeers. They become best buddies. I think that's the lesson he learned and the lesson I learned is that, I mean, you know, sex is great, super important. Friendship is even more sustaining, right? And you needed a group of friends. You know, you needed a posse. That's what I used to call it. And friendship, I think, is a theme that runs throughout the novel.
Oh, yeah. I'm curious, my first novel was a murder that took place in a bathhouse. And so As a result of that, I had to do a lot of research on bathhouses.
Mm-hmm.
A whole lot.
Oh, is that what you called it? That's what you called it? Research for your novel. All right.
I've done my bathhouse research, but this is a whole different type of research.
Whatever.
It's funny. You mentioned that many friends developed and everything after getting it on. Mm-hmm. My very first partner, after I came out, we met at a bathhouse.
Yeah.
And when we started dating and talking about moving in together, my friends were like, you don't meet guys at the bathhouse like that. And I'm like,
I hate that. That's ridiculous.
I said, you need to understand this. I said, you don't go to the bathhouse to meet the one. But if you happen to be there and he comes along, so be it.
Brad, I'm going to have to push back. I've had maybe 4 or 5, I don't know how you want to count, serious kind of partners in my life. Every last one of them I met at the bathhouse. And maybe some people will say, well, that's why you've had 4 or 5, you know, because you met him at the bathhouse. But I mean, where do you go to meet the one? Church? The poetry reading? I think 4 men who were beautiful, beautiful lights in my life, all of whom, the last one passed actually just a couple of years ago from the virus. Yeah, that's a pretty interesting place to be in life as well. I'm 62, and for all of the men that I've been involved with to have succumbed to this illness, it's even as recently. But anyway, met some wonderful guys at the bathhouse. Seth, have no regrets about that part of my life.
Neither do I. And he and I don't know how long we were together. It didn't work out, but we're still friends. We live on opposite ends of the country.
Right.
But sometimes we'll reminisce about that first night we met because it was kind of a crazy, bathhouses can be kind of a crazy atmosphere. And there were some funny things that happened regarding some of the other patrons, we shall say.
Okay.
And what's to talk about that and laugh? A lot of people, that would be very strange. And it's part of our shared experience.
Right.
So
right.
My husband, he and I have been together, and we've been married 15 years. Wow. We've been together probably 17. Uh-huh. He is the one. Uh-huh. But we met online. And there was a time people would have thought that was really weird.
Right.
It was a hookup site. And we met and actually didn't hook up. We ended up talking for 5 hours into the night. And the rest is history. But you never know where the one will.
That's it.
That's what it comes down to.
That's it. And ultimately, you have to be the one.
Yes, that is true.
You have to be solid in yourself and worthy and ready for whatever kind of relationship makes itself available.
If you enjoy Queer Writers of Crime, let others know with a review. It helps build an audience and introduce more people to queer crime fiction. Apple and iTunes are where most people search for new shows, but if you don't use either, other apps that allow reviews include Podcast Addict, Overcast, and Spotify. Wherever you listen to podcasts, help spread the word to tune in to Queer Writers of Crime.
The reason I mentioned the research I did for the first book, I'm just curious because you had named quite a few bathhouses in New York City that I presume were there in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
How many of those are left? Do you know?
Zero. I think the West Side Sauna is probably close. I mean, I stopped going to bathhouses some time ago, but maybe like about 10 years ago, I remember the West Side Sauna was open, but I think that they're all gone. Victims of gentrification and Giuliani and just changing values.
There's a few around. San Francisco actually outlawed bathhouses in the city during the middle of the crisis.
Right.
But there are two outside the city, one in Berkeley, one in down the South Bay.
Okay.
And L.A., I guess, before I was moved here, was known for a large number of bathhouses. And I think it's down to 3 or 4 now. I'm not really sure.
That's a lot, actually.
Yeah, it actually is. I think there were a lot more, actually, when I first moved here.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's still some around. And I tell people all the time, people blame the internet and that sort of thing. And I'm sure that has a lot to do with it. But there will always be that desire for some, there's just that certain thrill that comes from a bathhouse or from hooking up somewhere that is not the same. And there were always those that want that. So I don't think they'll ever completely go away.
Yeah, I hope not. I mean, you know, I have some younger men in my life as mentees and friends, and I try and understand what life is like for like a young queer man, like single, trying to be in a relationship, or trying to meet people, like meeting online, which is seems to be that, you know, the major way that people connect. Yeah, you know, I don't want to be one of these kind of like my era was better than your era. I mean, it's all crazy. We're all trying to find connection and love and fulfillment, however we find it. But there was sure something nice about being in a bar, seeing a guy across the room, offering him a drink, having him offer you a drink, chatting him up, you know, seeing what was going to lead. That sort of face-to-face kind of immediacy was nice.
What's interesting, you just alluded to something, I don't know your exact words, but something like we're from different eras. And actually, there's only a three-year difference in our ages.
Uh-huh.
And I was just pondering that. And one, because I was in the South.
Uh-huh.
But mainly because when the AIDS crisis began, that 3 years is actually a huge gap because of what you experienced from what I experienced when I, let's say, left high school. It was a much different world.
Right. The first time I read about AIDS, I was a senior in college in my last semester at Sarah Lawrence in New York. And I remember just opening the paper and reading about it. And my character has a similar kind of experience. And it has impacted on my entire life, on my choices, on my plans for the future, and or lack thereof, or fears about what the future held. I mean, to have AIDS be sort of underscoring of your adolescence and of your youth, it took a tremendous toll. And that's why I wrote the book, I think, was because I needed to see that experience told. And, you know, I mean, you know, I loved Andrew Holleran's Dancer from the Dance, which was sort of right pre-AIDS, like just right before AIDS. And then certainly some of the novels that were written during the AIDS period, but they mainly focused on white gay men. And I felt that there was a story to be told about the experiences of black gay men during the AIDS crisis and the ways in which we experience it. Because, of course, I mean, in the character, one of the early scenes in the book, the narrator and his two, what he refers to as his bar buddies, Lil Pete and Jeff, those are my favorite two characters. They're talking, you know, they're talking about AIDS for, you know, first time they're hearing about it. Well, they've heard about it. They're, you know, hearing rumors. And they said, that's a white thing. That's a white thing. Do you know anyone that has it? And the answer was no. So that's this thing. Are you sleeping with white guys? Well, maybe a little bit. You know, you're keeping it on the low. But yeah, we kind of messing around. So, but the thought was, okay, as long as you don't sleep with white guys, right, and as long as you don't sleep with anyone who looks sick, you'll be okay. And they're all having this conversation in a bar. And then a couple months later, the bartender, who was one of their tricks, has disappeared. You ask the manager, where's the bartender? He's gone home. And that's what happened. People disappeared. Sometimes they'd be there, right? They'd be in your life. They'd be like a sort of a peripheral character in your life, like a bartender. And then, you know, then they'd be gone. And you'd be like, well, where'd they go? Well, he went home to Detroit. Why'd he go home to Detroit? And then you'd hear the story that he was sick. And one of the chapters in the book is called Vanish. And that's what it's about. It's about the ways in which gay men vanished. Now, the vanishing was not always pretty. I mean, the vanishing could be quite ugly if you were there for it. And we didn't all go quietly. But you'd see someone one day and then they wouldn't be there the next. Or you'd see someone across a bar and you could see that they had physically changed. You could see that their skin had changed. They were thinner. The quality of their hair had changed. And you would try not to notice it. And you'd certainly try not to comment on it.
Mm-hmm.
And people would come up, like the character Zogby in the book, who is, you know, when I think about that character, I mean, he when he starts getting sick, he's like, oh, no, I've got a really bad cold. That's why I'm hacking like this hacking cough. Oh, you know what? I've got a rash. My doctor says it's a rash. And that's why he's got these blotches on his skin. And he comes up with every excuse, and we co-signed those excuses. We didn't want to see this happen to the men we loved. So we wanted to believe that it was anything other than this thing that was killing people. Mm-hmm. And then we would, you know, myself, but like, you know, would do these like daily, and let's call it daily, let's call it hourly kind of examinations, the lymph nodes in the neck, the, you know, lymph nodes. Mm-hmm. If I've had a call for too long, you know, I'm freaking out. So it was cuckoo. It was cuckoo. It was hysterical. That's, I think, probably the best word for it.
Well, I've never heard it called cuckoo. It certainly was. And mentioning Zogby, mm-hmm. damn you for making him so likable. There was grief there.
Right.
You know, and I alluded earlier, well, didn't I flat out said our experiences are very different. I'll flat out tell you, despite having a large number of friends that are HIV positive, as far as I know, I've only experienced one friend that died and sat with him in the hospital through his last days, slept on the couch or slept on the cot in the room. And that was gut-wrenching. And I mentioned that because I had a neighbor that was a real estate agent, and he, one of his clients died and left him huge, huge piles of Frontier magazines, which was LA's uh-huh. fag rag, as we called
right.
them, which used to be in every city and they don't exist anymore.
I remember Frontier. Yeah, sure.
And he asked me if I could help organize them by date. He was going to donate them to some organization. I don't remember what they were.
Okay.
And I'm going through and looking at the ones through the 80s. And from what I experienced, and I'm looking through these, and it's page after page after page of obituaries. And that was the first time it really hit me, like, wow, this was much bigger than... You know, when I saw the AIDS quote, I cried.
Mm.
When I saw this, I bawled. It just, I bring that up because your book reminds me a lot of Michael Navas, Henry Rios novels, because
mm-hmm.
they all take place during the same time period.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael has gone back and has been doing some rewrites because he's seeing things from a different perspective today than when he wrote them back in the 80s. So I was pleasantly surprised, because as I'm reading your novel, I'm thinking, wow, this is a lot like Michael Navas's novel. And I was pleasantly surprised, maybe shouldn't have been surprised, when I found a lovely review of your novel
uh-huh.
by Michael Navas.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yes.
I'm going to quote it because he really says it for me. Michael says in, this is just a part of his review. This is how he ends it. The best fiction not only tracks the transformation of its characters, it transforms readers too, leaving them with a deeper and more sympathetic understanding of what it is to be human, to be alive. Desire Lines did that for me, and I think it will for you too. And I want to say that is why you were here, because it did for me.
Ooh.
And I want to thank you.
Well, thank you. And for having me. To Michael, I read Carved in Bone and loved it. And what it is sort of about the same period, and Henry Rios' character is dealing with some of the same issues. And Michael's been incredibly supportive to me as I've tried to put this novel into the world. I mean, I think that I do. I mean, well, God bless you, first of all, that you only had to experience one actual death. What I do not want is like people to feel that the era, or that my book, is all doom and gloom.
No,
plenty of gloom, no doubt about it. But we lived as well. I mean, you know, we had to get on. I think, who am I quoting here? Is it Essex Hemphill? Get on with the act of living. Life had to be made. What were we going to do? I mean, and that's one of the things that the character, the protagonist, he comes back to New York in 1986. Right. And he's just positive, absolutely positive. He takes this trip. He joins the Peace Corps, and he goes to Zaire. He's just so sure that he'll die during the time that he's in Zaire, because, well, why not? And I think it's so poignant that, like, well, you reader tell me, I hope it's poignant that, you know, he goes to Zaire, which is the country that has been thought to be the origin of the AIDS virus. And so he's so convinced that he's going to die, right? And then he sort of says, you know, 2 years later, he's like, oh, shit, I'm not dead. Well, what am I going to do now? And I think that was kind of a lot of our experiences, people who were in their 20s and 30s. Like, it was like, okay, well, I'm not dead yet. And let me tell you something. This was before there was a test available for blood screening for HIV. So you talk about it being a crapshoot. Were you positive? You know, okay, you had someone who in your life, you know, sexual partner who had died, then, okay, I'm probably positive, but maybe I'm not. And can I hope? And so he comes back and he's like, okay, well, I guess I got to keep living. I got to figure out, what do I do? Do I get a job? Do I go to school? Do I get involved? Do I take the risk of getting involved with someone knowing that I might lose that person, that they might lose me, that they might have to take care of me through like one of the worst illnesses ever? So it was this great moment of uncertainty. And then, of course, once, you know, screening for the virus accompanied each other to the testing centers, and that was a whole other kind of experience of trying to be supportive in the face of so much fear. You know, it's funny because, like, as we're sitting here talking about it, I'm like, well, is there anything? Was there anything other than doom and gloom? I mean, certainly what there was support and friendship. And one of my favorite, I hope you don't mind me talking so much, but one of my favorite characters, is Puerto Rican Miguel, who, he's not a major character in the book, but he's a sex worker. Back then, we called him hustlers. And, you know, he's a hustler.
I still do.
He's all hustlers. Okay. All right. Not in polite company. So, you know.
Right.
So, you know, he's doing his thing. You know, he's making his money. And then he ends up, the narrator runs into him again, and he's a buddy at like GMHC, like providing kind of support. And then the narrator looks at him like, you're a buddy? You know, you're in the HIV support program? And Puerto Rican Miguel says, like, what? Because I'm a hustler. I can't be supportive. I can't be a member of this community. I can't help other people who are dying. And can I just say one other thing about that character now that we're talking about him?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for giving me the space. You know, really helped me with that character, and you know, I'm going to tell her about it when I see it, was Sarah Schulman. I mean, when her book, her history of ACT UP came out last year, I went to one of her readings, and she was talking about how the role of women, not the role of women, but the ways in which women were impacted by HIV and in those early kind of days. And the way they were impacted by HIV was they got HIV. And she was saying that, they died, and they lived and they died. And she was saying how there's a sort of this fantasy, you know, that's become popularized in the media and television shows and whatever about, you know, these all caring kind of lesbian women taking care of gay men, right, as they die. Mm-hmm. And sure, it happened, and I would never take anything away from the women who provided that kind of support. But what happened to women during during the AIDS crisis is women died, as you know, they were victims, mm-hmm. You know, or they were victims and survivors, and they were activists. So that made me, when she told me that, I was in my last, well, she didn't tell me that, but I heard her say it during her presentation, which I was in the last draft of the book. And I said, wait a minute, because my character was sort of AIDS caretaker person, was a woman. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm falling right into that stereotype. So let me pull that back. And I changed the character into being another gay man. Mostly gay men took care of other gay men. We showed up. Some of us didn't, but
yeah,
sometimes I didn't. And that's one of the regrets of my life. But most of us did.
I do want to speak to the gay and lesbian relationship, because you definitely made me think of something. But I do want to stress what you said earlier, that this is not a book about doom and gloom. It takes place during an era where this was happening. And how could you not include it? But it's really about life. It's totally about life. It was sad at a certain moment. It was more than sad at moments. But not once did I ever feel like this was a book written to create pity from people so that they would say, oh, look what happened to us during this.
Right.
None of that whatsoever. It just, right. This was the time period it was written in, and this is what happened, and these are the experiences that made and changed this individual. It was that simple.
Right. Good. because I don't want it to be maudlin. I don't think it is.
Oh, no, I don't think it is at all. No. Hey, I will say some would probably read it at moments, but life is
maudlin, right? But he also finds love or something. Yeah. I mean, he finds love. He is, you know, the character goes through sort of a early in the book or early in his life, he's mainly attracted to white guys. And the reason he's attracted to white men is because, well, why not? That's what the world tells us. You know, that's the Marlboro man. That's who portrayed as the standard of beauty. And, you know, he's in this relationship with Steve and who's a wonderful guy. But then he has this kind of experience and he changes it. So he meets this black man. And it's the first time he's been in a sort of healthy, well, we think it's healthy. We'll see. We'll let the reader decide, relationship with another black man. And he feels like he's gotten his prize. He feels like, okay, finally, you know, I've gotten what I'm looking for, a relationship with another black man who knows me, who understands me, who knows ins and outs of my life. And then things go south, as they tend to do.
With every guest I have on, they stress, this protagonist is not me. I'm not this protagonist. But then we usually end up in the discussion of, well, that may be true, but there's usually a little of us in every character in a novel. And I'm not going to say that your narrator is you, but boy, there sure are a lot of similarities.
What am I going to say? Of course. You know, it's not a memoir, though. Like, that's here's the piece. Like, because a lot of it's just not true. And a lot of the characters are amalgams. For example, the second, probably most important character is Regina, who's his kind of best friend. And Regina is certainly an amalgam of many of the women who were critical in my life. And I think that's one of the main reasons without really thinking about it, it just kind of happened. Regina is a biracial woman because the women that have played huge roles in my life have been Asian and black and white. And, you know, so I think I threw them all together and they made Regina. But, you know, I grappled with what, I mean, I've been working on this book for, can I whisper it, 10 years?
That's not abnormal.
Yeah. Can I say, hopefully, the next one?
Especially first novel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I started out as essays, right? I was, you know, going to do, you know, write the whole thing as essays. And then I'm like, oh, that's too preachy. And then, you know, sort of morphed into a memoir. And then I'm like, you know, my life's not that linear to have rises and falls. You know, everything in my life didn't like get resolved in 1 year. And okay, now I'm done. You know, now smooth sailing from here on in. So then I said, well, I think fiction is going to be the best form. And it really allowed me to come up with some characters who never really existed in my life and to come up with some scenarios to make things more kind of to be able to follow a plot that rises and falls in a way that is attractive to a reader reading a 265-page work of fiction.
And I don't know if your hope was to educate, but I think a lot of people that would never say, oh, I'm going to pick up a book about gay men in the 80s, a nonfiction novel, and read what that was like. Somebody that may never do that would read an incredible novel like yours and experience it. And they're educated by that, whether they want to be or not. Just it is.
Yeah. I mean, I hope so. And I try, you know, it's funny, I was just talking to a friend of mine about that. How much work do you want your reader to do, right? Certainly another black gay 62-year-old man will have less work to do, you know, in terms of like creating the cultural context so that everything doesn't have to be explained. But I try to provide context. The very first scene in the very first chapter in the book is that he's cruising in Central Park in the Rambles, and he gets into this crazy threesome in the park, and the narrator has these conversations in his head about tops and bottoms. And I think that straight people, you know, they may not know too much about, like, I mean, you know, they're not, anyone who knows anything about knows what a top and a bottom is, but like, you know, really sort of the thinking about how do we perceive, especially in the 80s when things were very role oriented, more than they are now, I think, way more than they are now, I think. Like, he has this reflection about everybody's looking for a top. I mean, I'm sure some young men would say the same thing too. And, you know, white men have certain fantasies about black men. They fantasize about a Mandingo stepping out of the jungle. And black men have the same kinds of fantasies about homeboys and b-boys. And so there's this whole reflection on roles, tops and bottoms specifically. And I try and set it up in a way that you don't have to be part of the culture to understand it, and you might even find it kind of interesting. So I try to provide enough guideposts.
You reminded me of the old joke, how are gay men like Tupperware? There's always too many bottoms and not enough tops.
I have never heard that, but I mean, that's a whole nother podcast episode.
But it's funny that you mentioned people now know what tops and bottoms and that are and that sort of thing. And I will tell you, a question I used to be asked a lot that drove me crazy, and I have not been asked in years and years now, is
who's the man?
Which one of you is the man and which one of you is the woman?
Who's the husband?
Oh my God. I actually was in Puerto Vallarta the first time I was asked that. My jaw hit the table and I said, you realize that we're both men. That's what makes us gay.
But let's be fair. I mean, we're talking, so let's talk. Like, the character, the protagonist, is the top. Mm-hmm. But, and he says it. I'm a top by default. Not because I really choose to be a top, but because, you know, I'm 6 feet, I'm husky, people see me as a top. So like you say, there's not enough Tupperware. There's not enough top. So I'm a top. You know, it's interesting because he sort of has to ask himself, as I think many of us did, like, did being a top save him from being seropositive? AIDS transmission, I'm sure there's some health educators out there, they're not going to say I'm wrong, but transmission of the virus through receptive anal intercourse was the most common method. So there was stigma, like, for people who, you know, not just for being HIV positive, but the notion that you must have bottomed at some point, you must be a bottom. But he doesn't really want to be a top. You know, he's just a top because that's what the role people have placed him in. And so then he gets into this relationship. He is allowed to be a bottom. And he feel like he died and went to heaven, right? Because that's what, you know, that was part of his fantasy all along. And I think there's a real thing is that gay men, queer men experience. And I think for black men, you know, there's double stigma against bottoming. I mean, nobody was a bottom to let them tell it.
Yeah. Right?
Because we're already dealing with issues of challenges to our masculinity, challenges to our, you know, our role as men in society. So then to be an open bottom, an identified bottom, was something a lot of black men didn't want to embrace, even though that was their, you know, sexual preference.
That stigma still very much exists today, not to the same extent, but let's talk about bisexuality. And anybody that wants to tell me that there's no such thing as bisexual is bullshit. But when it comes to how people identify themselves, a much significantly larger number of, I would say, black men and Latino men refer to themselves as bisexual rather than gay.
Yeah. If they even use that term.
Yes. Straight men that like dick.
Yeah. You know, I just mess around, or, you know, I don't believe in labels, and you know what? I'm good with it. I really, you know, I come from a generation, we fought really hard to be able to say openly we were gay. We fought hard. There's not an easy road. So it took me a long time as kind of a man in my 40s and 50s, as I saw younger gay men sort of rejecting that label. I was like, all this work I did, and now you don't want to embrace the label. But it's sort of like the character of Devin in the book, who he says, "Look, I'm clear on who I am. Like, I'm not hiding. I know who I am, but I'm not ready to be booed up with you. I'm not ready to, you know, marry another man, be in a relationship with another man. I'm not confused that I like dick, but this whole kind of, you know, relationship thing, which is what the narrator wants, that was not acceptable to him in his worldview."
And let's talk about the narrator.
Mm-hmm.
Because through this whole interview, we've referred to him as the narrator and the protagonist.
Right.
And now this novel is written in first person.
Yes, it is.
And as I was preparing for this interview and I'm scratching all my little notes, I'm like, what was his name?
Uh-huh. What'd you come up with?
There were lots of nicknames throughout the story. Different people had different nicknames.
Right.
And I started just scouring through, you know, I use Kindle, so I'm scouring through page after page.
Right.
And I finally realized we never know his name. You never gave his name.
Right.
Why? Why did you choose to do that?
At first, it wasn't a choice. Like, I had written about a third of the book, and then I said, wow, like, what's his name? Like, I mean, you write short stories. I just read Bound to Love, which I thought was great.
Thank you.
So, you know, I mean, usually you're writing, and then you get to that paragraph where it's like, okay, what's his name? What's his name? Is it Stu? Is it Frank? Is it, okay, who, what's he feel like? And I just never got there to a place where he had to have a name. And then I'm like, okay, well, you know, if he doesn't, if a name has not appeared for him, maybe a name is not important for him. And I can let him be unnamed and let the reader give him a name if they so choose, or just deal with him. You know, and another element of it is, and I was thinking about this today, is that Black people are very into nicknames.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think I'm the only Black person I know who doesn't have a nickname. I mean, like, yeah. All my cousins, and, you know, I mean, it's a very, like, we're constantly kind of like sort of giving someone Shorty, Red, often around someone's physical characteristics or someone's personality. And what I realized is that he's got, like you just mentioned, Brett, he's got tons of nicknames. Mm-hmm. Like his buddy Lil Pete calls him Deep Thoughts. The Zogby calls him Kid. The counselor in I won't spoil, but the counselor calls him Sugar. So he gets named quite a bit. And so people sort of project onto him their names. And I hope it doesn't distract the reader, because people do notice it. And like, I don't want to constern people and make them uncomfortable, because people do like labels, but it's just something that kind of happened. And by the time I realized it, I was so far along that I just said, let me just work with this as a device.
I didn't find it distracting. And I'm not going to say it took me to the end to notice. Throughout the book, I occasionally thought, no, what was his name again? But then the story was so engrossing, it didn't.
Uh-huh.
And We said, he was called so many different names depending on who he was talking
yeah.
to. That I thought, oh, I just forgot, and I just continued on. And it wasn't, like I said, till I started making notes that I'm like, what was that guy's name?
Right.
So I don't think it distracted from the story at all. In fact, right now I think about it, it's kind of fun that you did that. And regarding Black men using nicknames more often, and that is actually something I never really gave much thought, but from my experience, you're correct. I watched TV growing up and sitcoms, and they always referred to their kids as son. Always son. And I thought, who says that? I was called Brad. You know, my parents always called me Brad. Well, I'm married to a Black man, and his parents always refer to him as son.
Right.
He's never Maurice.
Right.
He's always son.
You know, that's an interesting observation. My father, I think fathers tend to refer Black fathers to their Black boys as son,
mm-hmm.
which is, they don't do to their girls. They refer to their girls by their name, or sweetie, or
dog.
You know. But I think that relationship between a Black man and his son, it is defined by the word son. And because those relationships, the challenges of them raising a Black boy is so sacred that. Funny, I was just saying, I can hear my father calling me son right now. It brings back very good memories. Just love.
Well, yeah, you never hear anybody say, come along, daughter.
No.
That would be very strange.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the opening of the book, so we're not going to give too much away here. This novel is definitely gritty. I want to tell you the opening scene that you mentioned, I knew right away I was going to love this novel. But like I said, it is gritty. It opens in the early 80s. People are talking about gay cancer. I think AIDS is mentioned, but it was still in the whispers, as you said. But the very first opening pages, the narrator is on his lunch hour, cruising for sex, as you said, in Central Park. And if somebody wants an education of how gay men, right now I'll say used to cruise, it's not necessarily true, but used to cruise, this is an education right here. It's well explained, the feelings, the actions, in just a very short amount of words, you give that experience. And I said how many men used to cruise. Some still do that way, but that used to be the only way to kind of hook up. Nowadays, it's very, for some, it still may be the only way, but for many, it's just a choice. They like that thrill. You don't hold back on the descriptions at all. At any time were you ever concerned that some may find what you're writing gratuitous and that your goal is to titillate?
Yep. I sure was. Can I say that I was very influenced by the work of John Retchie, City of Night and Numbers. Were two of the first kind of gay novels that I read. And John, and actually the blurb on the cover of my book was provided by John. And I've never met him, but and he wrote with an honesty about sex and hustling and that I just cruising that I thought was just brilliant. So I really did debate. There were versions of that first chapter where he was always in the park cruising. He's in the Rambles. You know, I'm like, where else would you be? You know, at lunchtime, you know, but somewhere cruising. It was 1980. Duh. I mean, what part don't you understand? And a couple of versions of that chapter, or an earlier version of that chapter, he's in the park cruising. He runs into this person, that person. He's sort of going through, like, just, you know, just sort of, no, not this one, not. And then he leaves the park in the earlier version of it. And I'm like, that's a goddamn lie. That's a goddamn lie. And I'm doing that because I don't, just like you said, I don't want to shock. Mm-hmm. But then I said, Carrie, what are you trying to do here? Are you trying to tell the truth or not? And that is all I'm trying to do here, is tell the truth. That is all I'm trying to do. And what would have happened was exactly what happened. He meets this guy in the park. The guy calls his friend over, and, you know, and that scene is not, like, you know, detailed as is sexually what happens, because it doesn't need to be. I mean, we know what happens. See, I think, and there's plenty of sex in the book, and, like, I think that I never worry about my writing being viewed as titillating. I hope it is titillating, frankly, but I never really worry about that because, you know, I'm not the first person to say this. I forget who I'm quoting you, but that the sex has to serve a purpose. I mean, it has to tell you something. It has to tell you more about the characters. It has to tell you more about the moment, the emotion. Like, there's a scene late in the book where he's in Prospect Park and he's watching his ex have sex with someone else, like, from a distance. Mm-hmm. And that is described in very specific detail for a reason. Because you are in the park watching your ex have sex, you see every gesture. You see it because it is that excruciatingly painful to you.
Yeah.
So in that instance, I think, you know, being very graphic about sex serves, I hope, it serves a purpose.
Well, regarding what you just said, yeah, it is titillating, but it's very clear that that wasn't the goal of the book. It's only titillating because you were real. You were true. Like you said about if he had left and ran during the middle of it all, that would have been a lie. And to write this any other way would have been a lie. This is truth you wrote. And that's why it's titillating from my perspective.
Okay. I hope so. I'm thinking back on some of the my parents are both deceased. You know, when you lost your parents, it gives you an incredible freedom, you know, to be able to write, you know, what you want and say the things, you know, that need to be said. And I got no more, you know, shame. It was how we lived. And what it did was it brought us together. It made a certain sense of community. But, you know, or and, I mean, sex became poisonous. Well, you know, I am quoting, you know, Essex Semple here. And, you know, at a certain point, you know, he said, now we think as we fuck. Sex became risky. The men that we had once seen as our playmates became suspect, dangerous to us. I mean, there's always been danger and risk, you know, picking someone up at a park and bringing them home, or or even STDs, you know, which you know, we used to call venereal diseases. The narrator writes about showing up at the BD clinic kind of on a monthly basis at one point in the 80s. And it was no big deal. It was just kind of part of the cycle of what you did, even meeting somebody at the BD clinic and taking them home, or, you know, connecting with them in some kind of way.
You know, now that we're in the age of PrEP, it's gone very much back to that. Nobody thinks about STDs.
Right.
I'm on PrEP, so there's no problem.
Uh-huh.
It's come back to that.
Yeah. It's an interesting place to be. Like, I you know, my doctor asked me if I wanted to go on PrEP, and I feel like it's kind of late in the game for me. You know, used to wearing condoms in the 80s. I mean, once we sort of figured out that condoms could prevent transmission of the virus, you know, I started wearing them, and I really, unlike some gay men, it's never been a problem for me to wear them, even if I've had a drink or two. I'm glad that young, or not so young, gay men can experience whatever levels of sexual freedom they want with no pressure. I mean, you know, I think there was pressure in our generation, I'll say, to be sexual. Whereas now I feel like it's more of a choice. People can be bi, they can be asexual, they can be polyamorous. You know, the choices are just, I mean, we had all those choices. I think we just didn't call them the same things or call them anything.
Neil Plaxey was my guest last week. He's a great author. And the subject of condoms and writing came up. And because in writing discussion groups, the obligation of the gay man to ensure that they include condoms in the sex scenes is very big. There's that debate that goes on all the time. And I don't play that game.
Uh-huh.
And what I told him is, I don't mention condoms at all. My characters just have sex. I don't mention that they put one on.
Uh-huh.
I don't mention that they don't put one
on.
I let the reader decide what works best for them. I don't feel the need to lecture and educate.
Okay. Unless it's telling you something about the characters and the situation. You know, it's so funny.
There could be times it definitely is important.
Well, for example, the narrator in my book comes back to New York, and he meets this guy that thinks is going to be the love of his life. And they're getting ready to have their first kind of encounter. And the guy reaches over to the bedside table and pulls out a condom. And if they have sex at other points in the book, it's not important to talk about it. We can assume it. But it's important in that first experience because it says to him, this man cares about me.
Mm-hmm.
And this man is knowledgeable about what's going on in the world. And maybe this man will take care of me. So if it's a vehicle for telling us more about the characters and the thinking, then I'm all for it. But I hear you. I mean, I think it doesn't need to be overly emphasized.
No, and like you said, I think it depends on the novel. There could be a character where their choice to bareback is a very important aspect of the story. That's just not the story I tell.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree with you.
In your short story, there's no sex, the one I just read.
No, it's referred to, but no, there's no actual sex that takes place.
Right.
Good catch.
A bunch of other things take place, but not that.
That's for sure. Well, I really hate that we have reached the end of our time because we haven't even discussed you at all. Your life is so fascinating. Please tell me that you have a memoir planned at some point.
No, never.
Never?
Nope.
Oh, my goodness.
Never, nope. 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 I just want to keep writing stories. There's just so many stories to tell. And you know, I got to tell a few of them in Desire Lines. And I'm so grateful more than anything. I'm grateful to Don Weiss at Carroll Press. And Chuck Forrester at Carroll. I couldn't find an agent you know, to sell this book. And if you can't find an agent, you can't find a publisher. And Don, you know, had faith in it. So, nope, I already have an idea for my next piece. But my goal right now is to just put this book into the world and see how people feel about it.
Well, I would love to read a memoir, but nope. As long as you keep writing stories like this, you have my permission to continue.
Thank you, Brad. I appreciate you.
So glad I had you on.
It was a great discussion, right?
Oh, like I said, we can go for hours, I think.
Yeah.
Cary Allen Johnson and his novel is Desire Lines, and it releases coming right up in September 6th. Available pre-order right now. It has been a lot of fun. I think we could probably sit and talk for hours.
Yeah.
Thank you for being my guest today.
Thank you.